This is Nachyomi, Sefer Melachim Aleph, Chapter 6. This chapter and the one that follows it detail the major construction projects undertaken by King Shlomo, beginning with the Beit HaMikdash, the Holy Temple, and including his own palace, his summer home, and the residence of the Pharaoh's daughter, whom he married. Both chapters have an incredibly detailed description of the architectural design, woodwork, stonework, measurements of these structures. In addition to the sheer quantity of specifications, we're also faced with the difficulty that the meaning of many of the architectural terms is no longer clear and has been the subject of much debate among the commentaries. Each interpreter, therefore, emerges with his own vision of what these buildings looked like. This makes summarizing these chapters quite a challenge. The best way to develop a sense for the grandeur of these projects is to read the text itself. Nonetheless, I will touch upon a few of the highlights of this chapter. Shlomo's temple is clearly inspired by the layout of the original tabernacle, the Mishkan, from the times of Moshe, but it surpasses it in majesty, elegance, and extravagance. It took Shlomo's enormous team of architects and laborers a full 7 years to complete the project. Like the Mishkan, the temple was divided into an inner and outer section. The inner section is roofed, and it contains the ulam, or antechamber. This was an additional 10-cubit section that was added by Shlomo and didn't exist in the Mishkan. The holy, or the kodesh, which is called in Sefer Melachim the Hechal, and the holy of holies, which is called the Devir, while the outer, unroofed area was known as the Chatzer, both here and in the Mishkan. Once the construction project is underway, Shlomo receives word from Hashem. Hashem promises to consecrate and cause his presence to dwell in the temple, provided that the Jewish people continue adhering to the laws and principles of the Torah. The dimensions of this temple were significantly greater than those of the Mishkan. The area of each section was twice as large as the corresponding section of the Mishkan, and the ceiling was three times as high. Another noteworthy difference is that wood and stone replace cloth and curtains throughout. The Mishkan was essentially a tent. This is a building. The inner section's walls are covered by ornately decorated cedar. Engravings of kiruvim, palm trees, and flowers are found everywhere, and that's overlaid with gold. And its floor is also overlaid with gold. The Devir and Hechal are divided from one another, just as the inner section is divided from the courtyard, by beautifully crafted wooden doors overlaid with gold that have golden chains drawn over them. Various storage and workrooms, complete with doors and staircases, are built along the two sides and the rear walls of the Hechal. There are actually three levels there, a first floor, a second floor, and a third floor. The walls of the Hechal also have windows, which seem to be decorative rather than functional in nature. Or to be more accurate, the walls of the inner section, of the roofed section, have windows. Surrounded the Kodesh HaKodeshim, the Devir, as well. The contents of the inner sanctum of the temple differed to some degree from that of the Mishkan. We're going to learn more about that in the next chapter, but for now, in the Mishkan, only the Ark of the Covenant, only the Aron, was in the Kodesh HaKodeshim. But in the Devir of the temple, there were also two tall kiruvim of 10 amot high that stood on the floor, and their wings spread out so that the edge of the outer edge touched the walls of the building, and the edges of their wings that were next to each other touched one another. In other words, it was like their wings were spread out, and whatever wing was closest to the wall was actually touching the wall. Whatever wing faced the other Kiruv touched its wing, so their wings were touching one another. These figures were made of cedar wood overlaid with gold. When the ark is placed in the Devir, these statues will be right behind it and kind of standing over it. It's noteworthy that when assigning a date to this project, reference is made to the Yitziat Mitzrayim, the Exodus from Egypt. Namely, it began 480 years from the time the Jews left Egypt. The creation of a sanctuary for the divine presence was the objective of the Jewish people from the very moment of their departure from Egypt, as we learned in the Song of the Sea that they sang, when they declared that you will bring the Jewish people and plant them on your holy mountain. Machon l'shivtecha pa'alta Hashem, you've made a dwelling place for yourself, Hashem. Mekedash Hashem kodesh yadecha, your hands have established the sanctuary of Hashem. So there was a concept of the sanctuary from the beginning. The Almighty brought the Jews out of Egypt not simply to restore to them their freedom, their rights, their dignity, but also so they could follow in the footsteps of the patriarchs and represent Hashem to all of mankind. On a national level, we first proclaimed the existence, unity, and providence of the Creator through the erection of the tabernacle in the wilderness. which served as testimony to our relationship with Hashem. Now that a monarchy and stable government has been established in Israel, it's necessary once again to refocus on the true purpose of Jewish political success and prosperity. The King of Israel is charged with constructing an edifice that will outshine the most impressive royal palace in order to demonstrate that his power, security, and authority is merely instrumental to the mission of sanctifying God's name in the world. Hashem has blessed the kingdom of Shlomo with a level of sovereignty and independence that would have been unimaginable in earlier years when Jewish existence in the Holy Land was always precarious and seemed to teeter on the verge of chaos or self-destruction. The achievement of lasting stability then completed the process of the exodus from Egypt, finally providing the nation of Israel with a sense of security in their freedom, in their land, and in their future. As such, it necessitated another building project, the construction of a temple that would accurately reflect the new realities, the political, economic, and social growth that had been achieved. This temple would have to be grander, stronger, and more impressive than previous sanctuaries, a proper house of worship for the people of Hashem, who had finally reached the stage of development as a nation that they had dreamt of for centuries. It's also interesting that Shlomo starts building the temple of his own accord, and only then receives a divine message blessing the project. The prophecy is recorded in the text after Shlomo has already erected the basic structure of the inner section of the temple. Shlomo then proceeds to add the ornate decorations, paneling, and gold that beautify that structure. I would infer from this that Shlomo began working on the temple and then halted the labor, waiting for a heavenly stamp of approval for his initiative before moving forward. Unlike Moshe, Shlomo had not been officially commanded or directed to build the Beit HaMikdash. He undertook the project independently based on his own understanding of his responsibilities as king. At the same time, he recognized that the sanctuary could only be selected and consecrated by the decree of the Almighty. As the Pasuk said, Mikdash Hashem kunri yadecha, that it's by the hands of God that the sanctuary is established. No human being could establish the home of the divine presence unilaterally. Once Hashem authorized and granted legitimacy to the undertaking, Shlomo was able to invest himself fully in the project, now a partner with the Almighty in creating a home that would represent his name.